Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 10th of September. And we look at the psychology of voting this hour of our program. It should be a very interesting hour. A recent study of voter attitudes that looked at a 24-year period that was the work of a number of people, mostly done by Ohio State University, says that people are more motivated by the threat of something bad than the opportunity for something good. We really want to like these people who are running for office, and the study shows there's an element of optimism in how we approach politicians. People approach each new politician with hope and optimism that maybe this will be the hero they've been hoping for. If it turns out we can't stand either candidate, we're not very likely to vote because either way we lose and the choice turns us off. If we like both candidates about the same, we're also less likely to vote because either way we will win. So in order to have a higher turnout, we need a saint and a villain. We'll be looking at why it is that following Kennedy's defeat of Nixon in 1960, voter turnout has declined steadily through 1988. It rose a little bit in 92 and fell again in 1996. All indications are that a number of us will be voting this go-around. We'll talk about negative advertising and if it works, if it's done with enough taste. And we'll talk about the first meeting and how important it appears to be down the road. This study says that the end of the campaign, saving money for the end of the campaign, is just not a good thing to do, and candidates tend to do that. You can spend the same dollars making a first impression on people, and that will have more impact on their ultimate behavior than throwing in something at the last minute. So those are a few of the issues on the table this hour. We have two guests with us, Professor Samuel Popkin, Professor of Political Science at the University of California, San Diego. Professor Popkin, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. You're my home team because I'm from Superior, Wisconsin.
Oh, you are? So many people who are on this show have Wisconsin connections.
Good people do.
All good people. We're smart.
Even in California with a governor who was educated in Superior.
That's right. People don't know that. That's a good trivia question.
My homeboy.
Yeah. It's a great. I love that part of Wisconsin. Also joining us is Professor Drew Weston, professor of psychology at Emory University. Professor Weston, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Happy to be with you. I wish I could say that I had those same roots to Wisconsin, but I'm a Georgia boy.
You're a Georgia boy. All right. That's okay. Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Thank you both so much. We have so much to talk about. I thought this study was really interesting, and whoever wants to respond first, in order to have a voter turnout, we need a saint and we need a villain.
It sounds like every religion.
Well, you know, it does have I think one of the things it's probably getting at is that people listen for stories, and stories have a structure that usually includes a hero and a villain, and, you know, there's some problem that needs to be overcome. And if you think of all the stories that you read your kids at night, you know, or read your grandkids at night, they all have that same structure, and actually our brains appear to have evolved to expect that kind of structure and communication. So, you know, when politicians tell stories that have that kind of structure of there's the good guys and there's the bad guys, it naturally appeals to not only probably our evolutionary past, but it appeals to all the movies and the stories that we've heard since the time we were kids.
Right. And I think Professor Weston is the scientist who's done the most to show how the brain works this way, and it explains why there's always a time in the primaries when the outsider, the unknown person, is so exciting because you don't know anything bad about them yet, and you can fill it in. And it's very often like that first date when your kid comes home madly in love with somebody, and they don't even really know the last name yet, but the first impression was so good. And I had to change my language this year because for years I've talked about the white knight, and of course the white knight for the Democrats this year was black, so
right.
I had to change it to the knight in shining armor.
Right, yeah. How interesting. What an election. Well, what about this idea? Polls are showing yesterday, if you want to put any faith in polls, that people like both McCain and they also like Obama. The other thing we're hearing is we're going to have a record turnout, but according to some of these studies, if we like both of them, we're less likely to vote?
I don't think that many people like both of them.
Really?
I'm doing the polling for The Economist magazine. I think the really likable person right now is Wasilla, Governor Palin,
mm-hmm.
who is the right now is the fresh, unexamined, new face, sort of the hot governor, and that's the excitement. Senator McCain was very well liked in 2000 by Republicans, and is not, to my surprise, as well liked this time, and is looking very old to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. So she's the new person. We've already established that who she is on the basis of personality. We like her personality.
There's two things that struggle in us. We like people. We want people to be likable, and we want people to be competent. And if you like them enough, you'll just take it for granted they're competent. And she came across as so fresh and invigorating to a lot of people who don't feel represented, maybe the way John Kennedy did as the first Catholic, that it's a very exciting time for a lot of people, regardless of the actual facts that will come out.
So. Mm-hmm.
No, I'd add to that too that I just have to say it's such a pleasure to be on with both you and Professor Popkin, because this is the first time I think Professor Popkin and I have met, and I've been admiring.
Yeah, we're admirers of each other who have never met.
You know, it's really funny. So great to meet you, but anyway,
well, it's close. At least it's a start.
The other thing about the Palin selection and why she's gotten such popular appeal that gets to the question, Kathleen, that you raised at the very beginning about candidates waiting until the end is something similar, which is I think one of the biggest mistakes the Obama campaign has made.
Interesting.
In this campaign was. Not to tell a story about her before she got her story out first. Mm. And I wrote about that the week before, as soon as the nomination was announced, and said, you know, what the last thing that you want to do is to allow two stories to emerge. One was that Palin is this wonderful combination of Mother Teresa, Supermom, and Wonder Woman.
Mm-hmm. Don't forget Annie Oakley.
Annie Oakley. And who can solve the conflict that so many American women and American families are facing of how do you balance work and home, and seem to do it in this miraculous way. And the second story that the Obama campaign did not want to come out of the Republican convention was that McCain's pick was actually a really maverick pick, and it was a really good pick, and they could have prevented both of those narratives from emerging if instead of saying at the you know the first words that came out of the Obama and Biden camp were really effusive, overly effusive congratulatory comments. I mean, it's fine to say we congratulate her, but it would have been much more effective to say this was a phenomenally reckless, impulsive thing for John McCain to do. He's a 72-year-old man with a four-time recurring melanoma, and he's picked to be a heartbeat away from the presidency, a woman who wouldn't be on anyone's top list of 1,000, let alone top list of 5, to be the leader of the free world. And he's the same person who's been hammering away at if this were Barack Obama speaking, hammering away at me for lacking national security experience. And her national security experience is that she's got a passport and she lives near Russia. I mean, that is that you want to talk about not putting country first. That was putting personal ambition first.
Mm. Professor Weston is 100% right. And now the problem is your son comes home or your daughter comes home madly in love with somebody about whom they know next to nothing, like Governor Palin. When do you deflate the bubble? How do you get them to find out that the person just got out of jail or the person never held a job? I mean, how do you get the evidence to deal with feeling?
Mm-hmm.
And by not having the story out, the Obama campaign is in a difficult position, as earlier Senator Clinton was with Senator Obama.
Yeah, but the problem with this is that nobody had the story out. I was amazed how many national commentators who even have served in Congress didn't know how to pronounce this woman's name. Everybody's scrambling to get a plane to Alaska to find out about her. She probably caught the Obama-Biden campaign by surprise as well.
Oh, I'm sure she did. The fact is, we know that Senator McCain desperately wanted his well-respected good friend Joe Lieberman,
sure,
And when they finally got through to him and said, you can't do it, and he had one day left, he settled for somebody he felt good with. It makes him feel young and lively, and that's a very good thing in a candidate, to have a running mate that pips you up. Mm-hmm. But I keep thinking of a line Jody Powell used to say after the Carter time was over, when he would talk, and he said, the most dangerous time in a White House is when a very well-examined idea is suddenly confronted with a fresh idea. Because you've got something that's got warts, and then here's something that nobody knows the warts yet.
Right.
And it feels so much better.
But does it feel better to everybody? It seems, I know that a lot of people see her as a breath of fresh air. They're going to rallies in huge numbers to see her. I also hear from a lot of people who are very concerned about this nomination. So don't we have a split here in how we view her?
Sure, but if you gain 5 or 6 points when the country is so evenly divided, that can be enough. And if it takes time, if it takes time for the competence issues to fit through the fantasy and the dream, you've only got 60 days.
Mm-hmm.
That's absolutely right. And in fact, you know, just to echo something Professor Popkin has said, is I don't mean to be too reductionistic about it, but going back to this issue of it's so much harder to change the story after it has captured the popular imagination. And it is just like, you don't want to say to your kid, well, actually, are you worried about that drug history he has? And if you try that, those kind of factual, rationalistic, you know, well, aren't you concerned that she has a lack of experience in X, Y, and Z, and that she doesn't know what Fannie
and Freddie are? Put him on the defensive.
You know, we've studied the brains of partisans, and when you when someone is already in love with their candidate, nothing that you say like that has any impact. It would take at this point take a revelation like emails in her trooper gate in Alaska that say that she was interfering with she had somebody fired and wanted to get somebody else fired,
right,
because of her personal family circumstances. That's the level of thing it will now take to take away the
impact. Professor Esten has right. Until something happens personally about her, we're riding the bubble. I am a strong Democrat, but this worry of mine about people like Governor Palin goes all the way back to Jerry Brown and Jimmy Carter in the 70s, or Wendell Willkie, the Republican I've been reading about in 1940. It's, to me, the most dangerous thing in a democracy is the Ross Perot phenomena, when somebody says everybody else isn't doing it because it's simple and it's practical, and whether you're Ross Perot or Betty Crocker or Annie Oakley, it sort of makes it sound like it's their fault, not your fault, and it's going to be easy. It's not that you want two things at once. It's that the wrong people were there to give you both things at once.
Yeah.
And remember how long it was before Ross Perot's bubble popped. And that's the brilliance of this move of choosing Sarah Palin is he chose Sarah Palin with 60 days left.
Right.
You don't have time to break a bubble in 60 days.
Interesting. Well, considering the fact that a lot of people have this great positive image of her, she's the star, she's a great celebrity, if you were running this campaign in order to keep that, the impression that we have of her, would you just let her hunt moose for the next 60 days?
Well, I'd do what Richard Nixon did in 1968, and I would simply put a lot of film on the air of her answering questions and let people worry about the fact that it was friendly audiences or she knew what the questions were. You don't have to win the vote of Madison to win the election. Get the college vote to win this election if you can get another 5 or 10% with her.
Mm-hmm. So would you put her in front of the press or not?
No, not until something came out so bad that if she didn't go in front of the press, people would believe she was hiding.
Mm. What about this investigation that we're supposed to see some results of on Friday? Is this at all meaningful to the American public? Are we watching this?
I think the Troopergate kinds of investigations are so complicated And the fact is, if you're really going after somebody who was really bad to your sister, that's too natural to really make her look
right.
unfit for
right.
office to a lot
right.
of people. It's going to take something like she really was skimming on her expenses or lying about her personal life, or maybe she faked her college diploma. It's going to take the kind of a thing where you faked a diploma or you really have been married four times. By the way, none of which do I have any. I'm not suggesting any of
right.
these. I just that it's going to take something. If you remember, Gary Hart had changed his birth date and his name and couldn't explain it. And then suddenly Mondale could say,
right.
where's the beef?
Yeah, exactly. What about this using the per diem amount so that she could stay at home? Does that trouble potential voters more than...
Well, it might, but I don't have a crystal ball, but certainly that could look, charging the state for her husband and her children. I mean, the women who are fighting in Iraq don't get child care.
Mm-hmm.
That's possible that could be the kind of, if you will, tarnish on the silver.
Right,
but I don't know. Professor Weston might have a better idea.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think it goes back to what we were talking before about stories. You know, that if you start to build a coherent story that, now wait a minute here, this is a person who, and you start listing ways. You know, she said she sold that plane on eBay. Well, actually, that's not really what happened. You know, she said that X, she said that Y, and that's not really what happened. If you start building a story that says, you know, we've just had 8 years of a president who believes that truth is optional, do we really want 8 more years like that? That's the kind of story that if you have enough examples of it, that I think would stick. I think these isolated incidents, I agree completely with Professor Popper, Professor Popkin, is if they are isolated stories, they are like shooting darts at a military plane. They're gonna bounce
right.
off, and they're not gonna have any impact. Mm. But if you do tell an alternative story, and there's enough data behind the story to make people start to get anxious about her and start to think, wait a minute. Is she who she says she is, which is what the Republicans did to Barack Obama, and that's why his negatives went up, then they could get some traction. But they don't have much time.
My cousin asked, my dear cousin Sharon said to me, what can we do? And I said, tell people she'll screw you more ways than you know.
Huh. You know,
but you've got to think of some funny way of using irony or humor to get people. You can't just say she's a bad person.
Right.
Or... anything that attacks her head on makes people defend her.
Don't you
and
find
that's why you have to have very good evidence and be careful and make your story.
But don't you find it remarkable, gentlemen, and tell me why this is the case. She's not running for president. Maybe she is on some level because of the age of McCain, but she's not on the top of the ticket here. So why are we consumed by this? Why is this such a huge part of the election?
Well, number one, we're Democrats, and many of the public radio audience are Democrats, and we're consumed because she's made half of the Republican Party, who didn't like McCain's secular, non-religious ways, feel very good because they feel like with somebody like that in the White House, creationism will be protected and stem cells will not be researched. So there's a lot of reason for people to suddenly be excited. Just remember how excited environmentalists were when Al Gore was picked.
Mm-hmm. Let's pause for a moment and go to phone calls. We have one line open. We're talking about the psychology of voting this hour, which takes in, as you can tell from the conversation so far, a whole lot. Our guests are Professor Samuel Popkin, Professor of Political Science at the University of California, San Diego, originally from Superior, Wisconsin, and Professor Drew Weston, Professor of Psychology at Emory University. Grab the line if you'd like to. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, that's talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program this Wednesday, the author of Loneliness, Human Nature, and the Need for Social Connection. We go to your phone calls now, starting with Roger from Iowa County. Hi, Roger.
Hi.
Hi.
Everything you guys are saying makes perfect sense, and I want to add just a touch of the whole you don't know them, you like them to start with before you know anything bad. And this whole, it all started, you know, a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, with some bad anonymous blogger was saying terrible things about Sarah Palin, about her child, her daughter's child, who's who, and that it was some liberal blog. And I believe there's never been identified who that was. And personally, I have no proof, I have no research, but I wouldn't put it beyond the conservative side to have written those anonymous blogs, because when you're introduced to the new fresh face and it comes with, and they come with a sympathy card, even better.
Professor Popkin, you want to take that on first?
Well, one of the problems with the blogs and the blogosphere is you don't know the motives of the people and how honest they are. I mean, how many lists have we gotten that were phony of the books that allegedly Governor Palin banned, for example? I still don't know if what she did and when.
What about the, I've wondered about this, because you have to really think about whether or not this plays all right, or how you're going to play this, or if it doesn't play all right. Because evidently, Senator McCain didn't know about the pregnancy of her 17-year-old daughter until the day before he announced that she was going to be the vice president. What do you think about that, Professor Weston? If he had known earlier, would she be on the ticket? Because that's it's such a controversial kind of issue in this country.
Well, this is a big difference between Republicans and Democrats, and that is that Republicans, when they campaign, they play chess. They think six moves ahead, and they knew immediately how to handle this, which was you turn this into one more example of how she is a paragon of virtue who follows her values. And so this ended up being a net plus for her. That was not a net minus for her. The Democrats, in contrast, play checkers. They think one move ahead, and they say, oh, you know, we better not say anything about her because she's a woman, and people will say we're picking on a woman, or they'll say, "We better not say anything about her and John McCain and George Bush's radical position on sex education, which is that kids shouldn't get any in school except abstinence only, and that actually about 85 to 90% of Americans strongly want their kids to get real sex education." Now, they wouldn't have had to personalize it to her kid, but they could very easily have said, even to take it to abortion. Probably the strongest message they could have made about Sarah Palin from before she introduced herself to the country, and they could do it now. It would be simply, you know, we tremendously respect and admire Governor Palin's difficult, highly personal decision, the decision of her and her family over the last few months to make two very difficult decisions about a child with Down syndrome and about an unwanted teenage pregnancy. We admire the decision that she made, and we think it came from a place of faith for her. But what we do not admire is the fact that she believes that the government should make those kind of highly personal, painful, difficult decisions for all of us, and that we believe that those decisions should be left to families, because that's what we believe about family values, and that's what we believe about government intrusion. And if they had done that, it would have taken all of those themes that Republicans have been using against Democrats for years and turned them on their heads, and the average person would have said, wait a minute, she's going to force me to have a Down child if my spouse and I have one. I mean, that's a decision we should make. Or she's going to force our pregnant daughter to have a kid. I'm not okay with that. And that would have made people, if that had been said before people saw those pictures of her beautiful family and the new baby, they would have been processing that stuff in the back of their mind instead of, oh, wow, isn't she a superstar? What a wonderful person to have done what she's done. And isn't it great that she's got her daughter is marrying this young man who said on Facebook, you know, that I hate kids and don't want to have any.
Right. Exactly. Mike from Green Bay. Hi, Mike.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi. Love your show.
Thanks. Good
morning, Professor Popkin Weston.
Morning.
Morning.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a Democrat, okay? And I'm kind of put off by this choosing a woman as a vice president. To me, it was kind of a an obvious ploy rather than a calculated intelligent decision, you know. For instance, how long did it take Palin to accept this nomination, Governor? In my opinion, a senator is more capable than a governor. But the way they're showing her, you know, her personality, etc., is subjective. I mean, my first impressions weren't that I wasn't too impressed with her. I thought it was reckless and irresponsible, to quote one of you.
That's one of the problems people have always had in the career of Senator McCain, the mixture of what makes a good fighter pilot is there's nothing between your eye and your thumb. You can sort of turn your brain off. And so you can either be brilliant by doing something quickly or you can be incredibly reckless. And as long as people are in love with Governor Palin, he's brilliant only and only if something flawed shows up. Does he look reckless for not knowing anything about her, he knew about the pregnancy the day before the announcement when there was no option but to go forward, and he would have taken her anyway, but he would have possibly had done other things if they knew as much as we're going to learn in the next month.
Yeah, thanks very much, Mike, for your call. Let me get a feel from both of you, because it's always been appalling to me that in many presidential elections, you've got about half the American populace voting, which is very, very low. Any ideas about where this one is going? Are we going to be extremely interested and vote in huge numbers? Or considering the psychology of voting, are we going to do the opposite?
Well, I'll defer to
ask me that again. I had trouble with that. I don't think I quite got the question.
All right.
I apologize.
Maybe it was a bad question. I'm wondering what your thoughts are about the turnout of this election, considering the fact that 50% usually vote, sometimes higher.
First, I hate to ever disagree with such a gracious and popular hostess. But, in fact, turnout has been relatively steady for the last 30 years. It looked like it was going down in large measure because we had so many people in the country who were not citizens in the 80s. And the turnout in 2004 was the highest since 1972. In this election, there is a legitimate good chance that the turnout in this election will be as high as any election the last 100
really?
Years.
Hmm.
No, the turnout is over 60% in 2004 of citizens,
mm-hmm.
of citizens over 18. And there is a chance that this will be higher than any Eisenhower or Kennedy-Nixon election.
Mm-hmm.
This was
people
also
are voting again.
Right. And this is, you know, obviously both Obama and Hillary Clinton inspired Democrats and quite a number of independents, particularly Obama, to come out in the Democratic primaries and caucuses. But, the brilliance of the pick of Palin was that McCain got the person who could inspire the extreme right, religious right, to come out to the polls, and because he was not going to get them. I mean, they have a very uneasy relationship with him. He was, in fact, against overturning Roe before he was for it. He was a moderate on gay relationships before he changed his mind. I mean, so there's two McCains running, and the social conservatives know the one who was there for 20 years in the Senate or 24 years in the Senate, and everyone else now is you know, remembering that McCain, but there's been a different McCain who's been running for the last 2 years because he really wanted to get the nomination. Mm-hmm. And that's again, it's another one of those stories that should be, you know, that the Obama campaign should be jumping on, which is, you know, there's one after another of these things where he really took a far right turn off that straight talk express, and that's the story that should be told. You know, this is Karl Rove's genius. I mean, he's genius without moral guardrails, but he's got genius. His genius is you go after the other person's strength, and you go after the story they're telling about themselves.
Right.
And Straight Talker and Maverick is one of those stories that the Obama campaign should have been going after in March and not starting to go after now.
Mm-hmm. Don't you find it just disheartening in a way that we're focusing so much of the television coverage is on personality, and particularly with Palin it is also with the story of John McCain?
We may be talking about personality, but people are thinking a lot behind it. Now, it's not my issues as a Wisconsin Jew, but for a lot of Americans, Governor Palin represents issues they care about. No scientific research with stem cells.
Mm-hmm.
Creationism given time in the class. Books taken out of the library. These are issues. We disagree on them, but when a person represents the issues, it comes alive for more people. So I don't think we should say there's not content here.
Except
it's
that
not my content. It's content I don't like, but a lot of the listeners to this show think it's real policy.
Except those have not been the issues that have been on the table in the midterm elections or the past few years. The issues have been Iraq and the economy and global warming.
The genius of this pick is that suddenly, instead of Iraq and the economy, those boring issues, we're talking about whether or not we should believe in science, whether or not we should teach evolution. For a lot of people, that's just as real. I thank God my kids aren't like that, but you know, somewhere in the world there's a lot of people like that, and I can't play God and tell them they're talking about the wrong issues.
Yeah, Rodney from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I believe this pick. Well, the pick of Sarah Palin has a lot underlined too of race. I believe the people that weren't going to vote for Barack Obama, which was a lot, just because he was black, gives them a cover of saying now Sarah, which they probably don't even like Sarah Palin, but can say, well, she's a good Christian woman, this, I'm not going to vote for now Barack. Now I can tell people I like Sarah Palin, but I wasn't going to vote for him anyway because he was black. And we miss those kind of issues that there's still a lot of people in this country that I'm afraid when they finally get into the booth, they just can't do it. No matter what they might say about Barack, that they can overcome, but it's like they're just not ready yet for a black president. It could be intelligent, smart, great, but and then they can say, well, Sarah Palin believes what I believe. And most likely, most people don't believe that extreme. I don't believe the extreme right has that much power in this country and that many people that would vote. Well, people do vote against their self-interest, but vote based on that one issue or two issues. I just don't believe that.
Professor Weston, take it on.
Yeah, the caller makes a couple of good points. One is that the religious right he's referring to is only about 30% of the population, and in fact, the position that Palin and McCain have taken on abortion. Democrats should actually be running on abortion this year because they're taking a position that's at 15% in the polls, which is that life begins at conception, no ifs, ands, or buts, and if you or your teenage daughter or your wife or if you get raped tough break, that's our interpretation of scripture, and therefore that's going to be the law. So, that's one piece of it. The race issue, he is also right about. It's showing up, you see this intermittently in polls, But polls are a tough way to get at people's feelings about Obama's race and how it's influencing them, because one, obviously, because people don't want to say to a pollster that I don't like him because he's black. But more importantly, I think that's the smaller percent of people who are influenced by his race. The larger percent of people are influenced by, you look at the numbers on older voters and how older voters have had trouble with Barack Obama, and they had trouble even in Democratic primaries. Well, remember that people who are over 55 and who are in this group of, and I don't mean to be offensive to people calling people over 55 older voters. I'm at 49, starting to get the AARP literature myself. But people over 55, you have to remember that when they were growing up and forming their ideas about race and about class and about status and about where people belonged and what hierarchies, they never saw black people above them. They only saw black people below them. Those things are, the biggest impact of Obama's race is unconscious racial attitudes. It's not the conscious ones. And yet when people say things like, I just don't know if I really trust him, or I don't feel like I really know who he is. Those are proxies for feelings that they have that are gut level feelings that they don't know where they're coming from. They just have those feelings. And again, the best antidote to these things is to our better angels on race are our conscious values. There are very few people in this country who believe consciously that we should discriminate against people on the basis of their race or color. It's just not that common anymore. And in that sense, our country's gone a long way in the last 40 years. But the flip side is that most white suburban people or rural people's associations to especially black men come from watching the local news and seeing black men hauled off in handcuffs after violent crimes. They may have driven through parts of town that are scary parts of town where there's a lot of violence. They see a drug deal. There are a lot of stereotypes, and some of them are based on experience of having been mugged, which the facts are that a disproportionate amount of violent crime is in fact committed by young black men. So that's what Obama has to deal with, and it comes back to this issue of values. If Barack Obama were to speak to a rural white audience in Tennessee or in North Carolina or in Georgia, or if he were to speak to a blue collar audience, white males in steel workers in Pittsburgh, and to say, just simply begin with something as simple as, you may have noticed that I'm black. Everyone in the room would laugh. The tension in the shoulders would go down. And if he said to them, look, the most offensive, elitist thing that I'm hearing out there is that people like you won't vote for me because you're all a bunch of KKK racists who look at me and say, well, I won't vote for him because he's black. And if you set the bar higher for me, that wouldn't shock me, because I can tell you in black neighborhoods, when a white politician comes by, the question that people ask is, does he share my values and does he really care about people like us? Those are probably questions that are banging around in your mind about me. So what I want to do today is to tell you about what my values are and what I care about, because my aspirations and my concerns for my daughters are probably just like yours, and why don't I tell you about those? If he were to do that and to make it conscious, the race stuff would start to dwindle away within about 2 weeks.
Hmm.
But the impulse on the Democratic side is always avoidance of controversial issues, and what I'm saying is very counterintuitive, because you think, well, if race is an issue, why don't we leave it alone? But if you leave it alone, it reverberates through those unconscious networks, those unconscious attitudes, where we are still living in the 1960s, as opposed to 21st century values, which have come very far since the 1960s.
Thanks, Rodney, very much for the call. Let's shift for a moment. It seems like a long time ago now, but The other image that is extremely striking to me was the Democratic National Convention, the number of African Americans, the number of minorities who absolutely were sobbing, were in tears because of what Barack Obama had done. I think that we tend to forget that. I'm sure that that part of the American voting segment will turn out in large numbers. But isn't that, I'm wondering how other people in America responded to that. To me, it was speaking to the powerless. To me, it was trying to include people who maybe haven't voted before. And it was a very big thing. He introduced himself, and it was an incredibly strong image, Professor Popkin.
It was an incredibly strong image, positive and negative, depending on your age and how open and comfortable you were with the changes of the last 50 years. I can tell you whether he wins or loses, we see less resistance today to a African-American president like Obama than there was in 1960 to a Catholic like Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think people remember that the first Catholic, Al Smith, had crosses burned and the Klan doubled its membership. When John Kennedy ran in 1960, one out of three Democrats voted Republican because he was a Catholic. And, of course, most of them said, as Rodney's question, well, he's not experienced enough. You know, you don't say it, but I think that we're going to see a lot of very positive and very negative reactions to sort of capping the changes of the last 40 years with somebody like Senator Obama. I mean, it's extraordinary. Nobody in my profession could have predicted a thing like this 10 or 12 years
ago. Yes, it is extraordinary. Let's go to Ken from Milwaukee next. Hi, Ken.
Hi. Wow, lots to say.
Yes, there is.
I am probably the typical sought-after voter. I am an independent moderate in my late 40s. And I've liked McCain for a long time as what he's done. He's been able to go both sides of the fence a lot. But I keep on thinking about a number of things. When I first saw Palin introduced when she was in Dayton, my first impression, and afterwards when I saw her acceptance speech, I thought, man, they better be scared because she's got Reagan-like timing. And there was other things that were going through my mind, too. Like, why is the right saying it's okay for her to have a child, she's having a child, but no big deal as far as, you know, I mean, that was no big deal, but with Britney Spears' sister, it was terrible. There seems to be a duality and a dual standard here. Also, the other thought that kept on going through my mind was, as we were hearing more and more about Palin, I keep on thinking, well, I like McCain, but God, this sounds like a decision like Dan Quayle. You know, she might have the timing, but does she have the smarts? Does she have what it takes to really be on the national forum? And a national visibility and making decisions like this.
So where are you now? Are you still undecided, or?
I am very undecided. As a matter of fact, I've felt that really the best people were not nominated on both sides.
Hmm. Now that's interesting.
The best people have never been nominated because the best people aren't willing to spend 4 years getting nominated.
It's a long haul, isn't it? It is a long haul. All right, thanks very much. Nice to hear from you, Ken. We're going to pause for just a moment and we'll return. We're talking about the psychology of voting in 2008 with Professor Samuel Popkin, professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego, Professor Drew Weston, professor of psychology at Emory University. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program this Wednesday, the author of Loneliness, Human Nature and the Need for Social Connection. Let's go to Jean for our next call. Gentlemen, hi, Jean from Eau Claire.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I think that the Republicans, again, have chosen a genius, in the psychological manipulation area. Also, I think an area is you know, how reality TV shows have become very popular. People live vicariously through the television. And all the characteristics of Sarah Palin is like, that could be me, that could be my daughter, that could be, how dare you say anything negative. They were geniuses at changing the focus of the election and getting somebody that the average person could identify with. And any negatives that they bring up, are it's on her character, it's on her character, it's on her personality, it's on her person versus the whole picture of what's really going on, you know, in our country today. They have geniuses, I tell you. The Democrats need help in this area because confronting, you know, the manipulation that's going on in our country today. And it's happening on the talk shows, too. You get Hannity, you get Rush Limbaugh. They have a lot of the area stations nonstop attacking Barack Obama and making the election on his personality, the person we do not know. So there's a lot going on here, and I hope you guys, you know, really pinpoint it, because the American people need to hear it. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks for the call. Professor Weston, you want to start?
Yeah, the caller, I think, is absolutely right, that what Republicans have understood for years, in part, I think, because they come from, they're more likely to come from a background in business where they understand the importance of marketing, that you have to, that the words you choose, the images that you use, visual images you use, the auditory cues you use, all these things really matter. This is something that Professor Popkin wrote about years ago, that people make judgments about you based not just on what you say, but on how you say it. So that, you know, if you give a rambling, discursive answer on the economy, people are, even though they are terribly worried about the economy, it's the number one concern of Americans. The unemployment rate just hit 6%. We've all lost 20% of the value of our most important, for most of us, what's our biggest asset, our home, the equity in our homes. Despite all of that, if you give rambling, discursive answers on the economy, and the other side says, you know, gives you a crisp response about how the free market and the global economy will solve this, then you're going to lose as a Democrat. In contrast, if you start with a statement like, you know, I want to see the words "Made in America" again. That kind of statement immediately grabs your listener, and they say, "Yeah, I want to see those words too," because that's American jobs. It's no more lead in the toys I give my kids. Or if you start with a statement that says something like, "You know, it's time that our major import wasn't foreign oil, and our major export wasn't good American jobs." Those kind of statements orient the person who's listening to say, wait a minute, this is someone, I like what he's saying. And that's the kind of thing that Democrats have been, they haven't understood they need to do for years. They seem to start to get it this year, and then, you know, and the Democratic Convention, I think, was a great example of where they really got it. And then they have just backslid again with, you know, Barack Obama's most recent television interviews were largely rambling, dispassionate, discursive discussions of topics without the punchlines that people remember that brand him and his party and make people say, all right, I like that guy. I understand that thing about Made in America.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that's at play here, though, and figure this out for me, gentlemen, we have perhaps the most unpopular president in the last 100 years who's leaving office. 8 years of a guy who described himself as an average person. You got a beer with him. People voted for him because of that. We have been suffering the last 8 years, and Republicans and Democrats will both agree to that. His name has hardly even been mentioned. He has horrible approval ratings. We're in a very unpopular war. People are hurting economically. Why is it that we say that we identify Sarah Palin as an average person? Haven't we rejected that in the last 8 years?
Well, you know, hope springs eternal. There's always hope for the next state, the next love, and the next politician. You know, John Galbraith used to say the bubbles occur. It takes the time between crashes is the time it takes us to forget the last one. And it seems that we're so resilient and so hardwired, as Professor Weston shows, that we keep thinking the next one will be real.
I think you said it more eloquently than I would have.
Let's take one more quick call. Jim, you'll have to be quick. We're almost out of time. From Rhinelander.
Hi. Sometimes I think the Democrats' unwillingness to fight plays right in the hands of the Republicans. They always say we're weak. They won't protect the country, and it kind of shows in these sort of things. You know, I have to watch a Daily Show and watch Jon Stewart make fun of Sarah Palin, who's making fun of Barack when he was a community organizer. You know, it's just, they should have jumped on that when she said that really was a nothing job because you had no responsibilities, but they don't come out and say that and fight about those things, and I think it just plays into the hands of what the Republicans always say.
Yeah,
you know, this is, if I could just jump in on
yeah,
that.
Yeah, quickly.
I think the caller is right on the mark. And what I've said to many Democrats over the last year and a half is, you can take almost any position on any issue you want as long as it's not the fetal position. And too often Democrats are crouching in the corner, whether it's national security, abortion, guns, and it makes people not trust them on national security because they don't think they've got spine.
Thank you both so much for an interesting hour. Professor Drew Weston, professor of psychology at Emory University, Professor Samuel Popkin, professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the program and to Katie Mattson for on-air production. We'll return following the news.